This Climate One podcast is sponsored by General Motors. How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Hackers break into just about every big system these days, from global ATMs to the Pentagon and national retailers. Today on Climate One, we'll talk about hacking into the biggest operating system of all, the Earth's climate system that runs our weather and supports the economy. For decades, a small group of researchers in the United States and other countries have been tinkering with the idea of hacking the sky. By spewing dust into the air, they say humans could simulate volcanic eruptions, which are known to temporarily cool the Earth. As temperatures around the world continue to rise, the idea of such geoengineering has moved from science fiction to serious consideration. Over the next hour, we will talk about the scientific, moral, economic, and technological dimensions of humans getting so hot they decide to break the glass and spray a huge fire extinguisher in the sky. Joining our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, we're pleased to have with us three guests deeply involved in the geoengineering debate. Ken Caldera is a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford University and a foremost expert on geoengineering. Oliver Morton is briefings editor at The Economist and author of the new book, The Planet Remade: How Geoengineering Could Change the World. Kim Stanley Robinson is an award-winning author of science fiction. His most recent book is Green Earth, a compilation of his Science in the Capital trilogy. It depicts a fictional U.S. President, Phil Chase, living in Washington, D.C. at a time when the Gulf Stream is disrupted and some winters hit like an ice age. It sounds familiar.
I get a lot of emails about that.
Please welcome them to Climate One. Oliver Morton, let's begin with a story. 1965, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson receives what is one of the first time a U.S. president receives a report on climate change. And rather than talking about reducing the source, Roger Revell had a novel idea for addressing it. Tell us that story.
Well, yeah, this is the reason that this story matters so much is because it shows you how attitudes to the climate and the right place for humans to be in the world can change quite strongly in quite short periods of time. So Revell has done the work in the 1950s that has shown that carbon dioxide is, contrary to some previous expectations, building up in the atmosphere. And he knows that this is going to lead to a level of greenhouse warming. And he puts this into the report of the president in 1965. It's a sort of like it's an appendix to this report. And he says, well, what should we do about it? And in 1965, talking to Lyndon Baines Johnson, you do not say, well, we're going to radically change the whole nature of capitalism. You don't say we're going to do anything about people making oil in Texas. You say things like, we could put lots of little reflective bubbles on the surface of the ocean and reflect back some of the sunlight. And at that time, the idea of a technological fix had not taken on the somewhat condescended to sense that it has today. The idea of a technological fix did not seem in and of itself absurd. And it's quite extraordinary that just in 50 years, the fact that that was the only thing that report said now seems extraordinary to us. But maybe in 50 years' time from now, people will say the degree to which people are unwilling at the present era to talk about this form of geoengineering, not little balls on the ocean, but any form of geoengineering, maybe that would also look strange.
There's another story. A few years later, Edward Teller and some other scientists were exploring the impacts. Obviously, this is the height of the Cold War, nuclear winter. And how is that connected to the evolution of what is geoengineering?
Well, it's connected in an interestingly interestingly unexpected way. When people talk about nuclear power throughout the early part of the 20th century, they link it in their minds with power over climate. Because it seems like a sort of like ultimate godlike power, and so the great British radiochemist Soddy when he writes the first popular treatment of radioactivity in the early 20th century, talks about how it can destroy ice caps and make deserts bloom. That's what nuclear energy does. Same thing happens straight after the Second World War. Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley's brother, talks about maybe melting the Arctic ice and making a new world for us all up in the Arctic, and this is the power of the atom. But when people like Teller actually talk about using atomic weapons, atomic power to actually fight wars, oddly, this story goes in reverse. And for many, many years, people do not talk about the climate impacts of nuclear war. And now it seems, again, in retrospect, blazingly obvious that if you set off huge fires over much of the surface of the Earth, you might do something to the climate. But there's a sort of like studied, and I don't think deliberate, but definitely psychologically telling, refusal to engage with that. And so the idea of nuclear winter comes about much later than most people think. I mean, I've chosen to correct some fairly eminent historians on this, that they all talk, oh, nuclear winter, that idea of the 60s and 70s. No, it starts in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It was an idea, it was a way of thinking about the world, a way of thinking about human power within the world that was very late to come to attention because there was a vested interest in thinking that in some ways nuclear power could end the world without changing it.
Or that a nuclear power, yeah, war could be fought and winnable, that sort of thing. Ken Caldera, let's have you explain what is geoengineering. Give us a brief explanation of this is a very abstract concept. How do you describe it?
There are two main categories of geoengineering. If we think about the global warming that humans are producing, it's primarily due to the fossil fuel CO2 that we're adding to the atmosphere. And this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere makes it more difficult for heat to escape to space. And so one approach, which is relatively non-controversial, is to just remove some of the carbon dioxide that we're adding to the atmosphere. But if we think about what's heating the Earth up to begin with, it's the sunlight hitting the Earth, and we're absorbing this solar radiation. And so another way to cool off the Earth would be to reflect some of that incoming sunlight back to space. And this is precisely what volcanoes do, and the Earth has cooled after each of the large volcanoes that have occurred over the last 50 years or so. And so the other leading idea is basically to emulate what big volcanoes do, put material in the stratosphere to reflect sunlight. And there's a few other ideas as well, but they're all based on the same idea of reflecting sunlight back to space.
Kim Stanley Robinson, is that comprehensive enough, the idea of either sucking carbon out of the sky or bouncing heat back toward the sun?
Well, I think that the common understanding of this term geoengineering has morphed fairly quickly to the notion that it would be a technological silver bullet, where you could do one thing and solve the problem of us burning fossil fuels. So people immediately object to it as a kind of a moral hazard, that if we think that we can get away with it, that we won't decarbonize fast enough. And then also there's a certain resistance to the technocratic in general of taking over of not just world history, but even planetary ecosystems themselves by some poorly defined technological elite with a method in mind. And so many things have gone wrong in the human interventions in this planet before that people distrust it on several levels. So it's getting attacked almost immediately for things that are not quite right or true, and yet there's reasons why these attacks have come about. For instance, people will say, well, you put something up in the atmosphere and then we're going to accidentally cause an ice age. And there's not an understanding that, like volcanic explosions, that dust goes into the atmosphere. For 5 years it's cooler, then it falls down to the ground. So in a way, this is kind of an experiment that we could run that has a natural terminus to it. So it's a little bit safer than other things that might be suggested. So, yeah, it's gotten complicated. I always try to say, well, geoengineering, if we plant a lot of forests, if we give all the women on the planet their full legal rights, we've changed the climate of the Earth in a radical way. So that's geoengineering, too. And this kind of blows the discussion apart, and I'm not sure that's where we want to go tonight. But I think it's important to point out that we're talking about humanity's relationship to the biosphere and the planet as a complex system that we can't hack, that's not the right word, but we might be able to finesse it in ways that will keep us from causing a mass extinction event. So we need to talk about it, but it can quickly get scary in several different ways.
Yeah, I don't particularly like the hack metaphor, but I one thing that you were saying I can't emphasize enough. The idea that there is, in some minds, and I think in some of the popular conception of geoengineering, that it's necessarily an alternative to reducing fossil fuel emissions is pernicious and wrong. There is no gap. There's no iron law that says you have to have one or the other. You can quite easily imagine worlds where you have both and the. There is this idea of moral hazard, this idea that if you have geoengineering, moral hazard being the idea that if you're insured against risk or in some other way immune to risk, you will be riskier. And it's clear that the moral hazard is a real thing in the world. You can look at the banking system and see an awful lot of moral hazard. The people will take risks if they think they'll get bailed out.
Yeah.
But that doesn't. And that doesn't apply only to geoengineering, and it doesn't apply only to solar geoengineering. The biggest amount of moral hazard that I see in the geoengineering debate at the moment is actually with the carbon dioxide stuff. I was at the Paris Climate Conference, and it was a very inspiring conference to be at, and it came away with the world actually having a system for talking about dealing with this problem, and with a set of ambitions of keeping warming well below 2 degrees, which is, you know, a high level of ambition, but with pledges on action that were grossly insufficient to that high level of ambition. And so what you're finding in the discussion about future emissions at the moment is there's an acceptance that in the second half of the 21st century, in the first half of the 22nd century, something somewhere will be pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But there's no real discussion about how that's going to be done. And that's where moral hazard gets really dangerous, because you begin to say, well, always we can trade off emissions cuts now with more sucking out later. And when you haven't really done the research in a way to find out how you might do that sucking out or what level of sucking out is possible, that's very tricky. So there's been a lot of talk about moral hazard with the sunlight mechanisms. I think the sunlight mechanisms from this point of view, not from all points of view, are kind of safer, because it would be a really big thing that, you know, there would be big political debate about to do that. At the moment, now that we've let emissions, now we've let negative emissions, carbon dioxide reduction, into our thinking, but haven't stopped to work out how to actually do it, I think that's the area where there's moral hazard at the moment.
Ken Caldera?
Yeah, just to build on some of what Oliver was just saying, in Paris, at this COP21 meeting, the governments of the world, if you look at what emissions they've promised to try to hold themselves to over the next decades, and then they claimed this 2-degree or 1.5-degree targets. In order to meet those targets, the governments basically need to remove large amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere later this century. So essentially, geoengineering, at least in the way of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, is the implicit policy of every major government in this world right now.
Well, some would say that stop burning fossil fuels would be a big part of that, that a lot of the technology already exists today, renewables are there, that somehow geoengineering is a way to let the fossil fuel companies keep doing business as usual and us to keep living like we do.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental... Again, this area is presented often as a dichotomy. Either we reduce emissions or we do these geoengineering
techniques. Okay, we've heard it's going to be both. Right.
And I think that maps onto this feeling like we can either change ourselves and our behavior and our social and political environment, or we can go for some techno fix. And I think there's just a feeling that we need to change our political and social environment, and that we can't just rely on technology. And this is really where Edward Teller comes in, because he never trusted social systems to solve problems and thought, oh, we need to invent technology to solve our problems, which is one of the reasons why we're here this evening.
So, Ken Caldera, where is the status of testing today? Is there any testing going on today, either openly or secretly at the U.S., at the Pentagon or anywhere else?
For carbon dioxide removal, there is testing. There's a pilot plant going on up in Canada right now, and also, of course, planting forests and so on is a form of carbon dioxide removal. For the sunlight reflecting techniques, basically all the research is indoors at this point, mostly in computers.
And do you think it should go outdoors? Do you think that there should be real-life outdoor testing of this technology?
I think with appropriate safeguards and oversight by appropriate governmental bodies, there should be outdoor experimentation. But I don't think just rogue individuals should go out and do it themselves.
Oliver,
there's a really interesting precedent here, which Ken was actually involved in that one of the more radical ideas about removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere was the idea that you could do it by stimulating plankton blooms in the southern oceans. And this was an idea that was brought about partly because it's an idea about how ice ages might start, and probably has a certain amount, not a complete, but a certain amount of validity in that area. And people tried doing it. And so they went out into the southern oceans and well-instrumented scientific experiments, dumped a lot of iron in, saw what happened. And it is true that there was increased photosynthesis, not to the extent that they expected, and there were various complications. But what's really heartening about this story is that people took the issue seriously. There is an international agreement about what you can and can't dump in the ocean. The people responsible for that took the advice of Ken and other people and started thinking about how to change their regulations to understand and take account of these scientific needs. And the scientific community decided that they didn't think that this really looked like a particularly effective way of sucking down carbon dioxide, though it's not a settled question. There are some people who still like it, some people who dislike it very much. But what I find interesting about this is that it was a kind of scary, weird idea that was tested and that was discussed, and that it was found that there were existing international rules for providing some level of governance. And so I think that's something, I hope you feel proud of it. Do you think that's something of a success story?
I think there was some overreaction there, but overall it was largely a success.
Ken Caldera, you've been part of a research effort funded by Bill Gates. So tell us, he has a portfolio of investments, nuclear power, et cetera, and how does this fit into his strategy, and what has Bill Gates been funding on geoengineering?
Well, first let's just say that he, along with his friends, have raised $5 billion for investment in clean energy technologies, and so his investments in clean energy technologies are 1,000 times larger than his investments in climate research of this sort. And so he funds my group largely, and also David Keith's group and a few other efforts.
David Keith is a researcher right now at Harvard.
To do innovative climate and energy research, some of which is geoengineering related, but our work is all with computer models and trying to understand the consequences of different things people might do. A few years ago, some of this money did go to fund proof of concept for a sprayer that could potentially whiten marine clouds, but that was all done indoors as a proof of concept. But again, his main effort is on trying to affect emissions reduction, and he sees that there's a lack of research in this area and was hoping the governments would pick up the slack, but they haven't so far.
Oliver Morton, you write about Greenfinger. There's a scientist at the University of California, San Diego, that writes about billionaires buying spaceships, et cetera, and Bill Gates in particular. David Victor?
David Victor, yes. David's a very insightful analyst of the political economy of energy. And David's worked a bit on climate geoengineering, and he dubbed the idea, he dubbed this idea Goldfinger. And the idea is that the thing about putting particles into the upper atmosphere like a volcano does is that you don't have to be all flashy and boomy and multi-megatonny like a volcano to do that. You can do that with aircraft or with balloons maybe or something like that. And there's debate about how difficult it is, but it's not very difficult. And in an era when a man like Elon Musk can, you know, build a space fleet, the idea of building the capacity to alter the planet in a way, in such a way, just out of one person's capital, is oddly plausible. The idea that it's possible. The idea that the political reality of the world would allow someone to do this without shutting them down, that is a little bit less plausible to my mind. And Bill Gates gets pulled into this because it's known that Bill Gates funds some geoengineering research at Ken and David's labs and a few other places. And so when you've got a billionaire and you've got this idea that this is, in an odd way, cheap enough that a billionaire can do it, I remember hearing someone from Google once talking about a space mission, and he said, is this really really expensive? Or is this something that a guy like me could do?
And so, to give an idea of the scale of effort, it's estimated that the amount of flights that it would take to maintain an aerosol layer, small particle layer in the stratosphere, enough to offset all of the warming expected this century, would be about 1/1,000th the size of the commercial aviation industry. So it'd be about the number of flights each year that occur by commercial aviation every 6 or 8 hours. So it's really a tiny, economically tiny cost.
And I want it to be even smaller than that, because enough geoengineering to counteract everything is a very high amount of geoengineering, especially if you're talking about geoengineering in some way being floated in on top of emissions reductions. You don't want to reproduce the effect of a large volcano. If you're talking about realistic scenarios down that line, you're talking about something actually yet more tenuous than that, easier.
So it's doable. So something that sounds like a science fiction novel, Kim Stanley Robinson, we're sitting here talking about it like, a billionaire could do it with a few planes, not that big a deal. I'd like to get your thoughts on how something like science fiction is becoming closer and closer to just simple possibility.
Well, this isn't what we're telling is a science fiction story, a science fiction scenario, and we're running several scenarios at once, and they tend to get tangled. But the single person changing the world is a very old science fiction story. Basically, the rocket ship that you build in your backyard and go to the moon. So this is a really common kind of a Horatio Alger story. But I think it will instantly get tangled with governance and will be something that the civilization at large can approve or disapprove, can shoot down or whatever. There are problems with the geoengineering of just blocking sunlight, in that if you keep on spewing out CO2, a third to a half of it ends up in the ocean. The ocean gets more acidic. If the ocean's more acidic, it may lose the bottom of the food chain, and then the rest of the food chain collapses also, and that's a third of humanity's food. So we actually do need to decarbonize as well as these other things. Okay. And the solar geoengineering is a kind of an emergency science fiction story. What if temperatures really begin to spike? What if methane begins to get released to the atmosphere off of the ocean floor, or the permafrost begins to melt such that the frozen carbon in the permafrost and methane begins to release fast? And suddenly, every year, it's like 2 degrees hotter than the year before, and we are clearly reaching a moment of crossing one of those tipping points into a completely different planet, a jungle planet. At that point, then you say, we need to put the dust in the air.
But that's the one that sort of scenario is the one that really concerns me, because that's actually a very common way of framing this story about geoengineering, that you hear the idea that it's a sort of like in case of emergency break glass sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And a time when the Earth is already going through severe climate changes and geopolitical panic is exactly the wrong time to launch a large planet-changing sort of effort. And it's very prone to, you know, the theory of emergencies that you get in Carl Schmitt and other places, that, you know, he who makes the emergency makes the rule. It fundamentally challenges ideas about democratic or quasi or pseudo democratic. Why do I keep saying that? Governance in the climate system. It seems to me that it's much, much wiser to talk about introducing small amounts of geoengineering at a time when the world is not completely freaked out, than large amounts at a time when it is.
Sure, but this is wiser means perhaps less likely to happen. When everybody would agree to do something is, I think, when after you have, say, the first food crisis, planetary food crisis, something severe enough to shock people. Before that, it will be intensely argued, and there will never be enough agreement for the world community to do it, and then you get the idea of the Rambo individual doing it on their own. If you run the scenarios, there's never a good one for geoengineering, unless you start talking about, let's reforest all the places that have been deforested, the Pacific Northwest, the Amazon. You can capture 100 gigatons of carbon by reforesting. Let's try out geoengineering once over the Arctic. Let's stabilize population. let's capture the carbon that we're burning when we burn fossil fuels. People are saying, oh my God, that would make energy twice as expensive as it is now, as if that's a stopper. Energy is insanely cheap. It's too cheap. So you make it twice as expensive and your bill for the month goes from $10 to $20, and it's really only the big industries that are being hurt by this. It really only hurts quarterly profit and shareholder value.
Well, that's
doesn't
true for
hurt daily
life. But, you know, there are 1.5 billion people who don't have access to electricity at all. Energy is not cheap to them.
But solar power has already become cheaper. If you didn't subsidize the carbon industry massively by taxpayer money, you already have the crossover power where clean energy could be quickly put in by government-supported projects. And it would be full employment, it would be a thing to do, and you could have clean energy so much faster than we thought even 10 years ago.
Let's let Ken Caldera get in here.
Okay, so first let's just all posit that everybody on the stage would like to see a clean energy economy as rapidly as possible, and we'll bring it back to geoengineering. The same climate models that project all these terrible outcomes for global warming universally predict that those climate outcomes will be much less worse with solar geoengineering applied at some reasonable level. And if you thought that we were eventually someday going to need it, the scenario that Oliver lays out, where it's slowly ramped in, where we sort of tiptoe into it, would be the most environmentally responsible way to do it. Unfortunately, the most environmentally responsible way is also the most politically difficult. And the political reality is closer to what Stan was saying, where in an emergency situation, there are model projections that suggest that mammals will not be able to survive outdoors in the tropics because they won't be able to evaporatively cool themselves. There's potential for widespread crop failure in the tropics due to heat stress on crops. And so there's potential for widespread suffering. And if that happens, the incentive, if there's a leader of a country whose people are starving and they think by injecting some particles in the stratosphere they can feed their people and alleviate suffering, the political pressure to do that's going to be intense. And so while I think Oliver's scenario would be the most environmentally responsible, I think Stan's scenario is the more plausible one.
Well, it's by framing scenarios like this that we make things plausible and possible. And one of the things I object to about the emergency framing is that it lets Ken and his colleagues off the hook, because they're then able to study geoengineering, saying, we don't really have to worry about responsible, plausible politics, because those aren't likely to happen. And if there's an emergency, of course, we'll use something. I think that if you actually think that something is good and could reduce harm, then you should be working on trying to reframe those politics from the get-go, rather than saying, well, we'll do this interesting scientific research, and it's fascinating scientific research. If I didn't think that, I wouldn't have written a book about it. But you can't just but if you just do that and say, well, the politics will only be the politics of the emergency and we can't have any say over that, then I think you're, to some extent, ducking the issue.
And do you think that doing research also makes it more likely that once there's more money, more funding, more jobs, momentum, that sort of researching something kind of puts it in motion to happening, Oliver Morton?
I think that people worry very much about technological lock-in. At the same time, governments put huge amounts of money into nuclear energy, and they're seeing less and less of that around the world. I don't think that the argument that just because we research something, it will necessarily happen. There are a lot of things. I mean, for instance, a lot of this work dates back to has its sort of like prehistory in debates about supersonic air transport in the 1960s and 70s. In the 1960s, everyone thought that the obvious next step for passenger air transport was to have supersonic planes. And my government and the French government actually did something about this, so did the Russians. The Americans talked about it and talked about what would be the effect on the stratosphere of putting lots of little particles up there. That's why this is familiar. And decided, and also thought about what would be the noise at ground level, and decided, no, that's not something we'll do. The idea that research necessarily leads to deployment, there are examples where it's the case, because most things that end up deployed have been researched, but there are a lot of examples where things have been researched and then quietly let go. And I don't think that there's any evidence that geoengineering is particularly pernicious in that respect.
I want to clarify that I like the idea of geoengineering because I think we're already doing it, and once we admit to it and begin to try to take control of it for good, we are in a more honest relationship with the planet. And I would agree that the best scenario would be to go ahead and try it out, and what's shocking about that is that trying it out is really the full thing. And that you put some dust in the atmosphere and see what happens to temperatures. And we know from volcanoes that really not that much experimentation is necessary. We know that it works at what it does. So, and also, I've seen the human terrain, the discussion in this civilization has changed so fast in the last 10 years that even now, us talking is changing the perception of what geoengineering is and how acceptable it might be. 10 years ago, we couldn't have had this conversation, but the 10 hottest years that we have on record took place in this century. So global warming is happening, and everybody knows it. The denialists are now just a fraction of the power that they had in this society 10 years ago. They're going to slink away from this and pretend they never said it. And we are going to be in a world of global warming. And geoengineering is going to be something that's talked about more and more. And it may happen in the good scenario rather than the emergency, where once you have a food crisis, everybody's going to be behaving with that level of craziness that won't be good for any human decision.
Although there's some recent evidence recently that the more the scientific evidence has consolidated around climate change, the more deniers, and actually I'm not so sure that denial has been gone down as the scientific consensus has advanced. You're just joining us, our guest today at Climate Wonder, Kim Stanley Robinson, a scientific author, science fiction author, Oliver Morton, the briefings editor at The Economist, and Ken Caldera from the Carnegie Institution for Science at Stanford. I'm Greg Dalton. We'll be right back after this break.
And now, here's a Climate 1 Minute. Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and other high rollers have thrown billions of research dollars into areas they're passionate about. Clean energy, space travel, geoengineering. But should we be letting billionaires pick up the tab rather than the government? Climate scientist Jane Long says that relying on private funding can lead to risky science. When it comes to experimenting with our atmosphere, she says, the government should be holding the purse strings.
The kinds of thought experiments and workshops and things that are being done through private funding, I have no problem. But once we get to any kind of an outdoor research project, you very quickly want to see that become programmatic and become strategic. Because as we move from very, very small-scale research with literally no physical risks associated with it, and if you ever move to something that's maybe still very low risk but large scale, say over 1,000 kilometers or something like that, 1,000 miles, you wouldn't want that kind of research to be done unless it was publicly available, publicly governed, and that was totally transparent to everyone in the public about what was being done and why it was being done. And you wouldn't want to take any risk at all unless it was somehow strategic research. So just because somebody's curious about something, you don't want to see that funded. You want to see it funded because it builds towards something which is determining whether or not these technologies would be effective, whether or not they would be advisable. And if you're not going to do those things in a strategic, public, transparent way, I think that's a disservice.
Jane Long is co-chair of the Task Force on Geoengineering at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She spoke with Climate One in 2015. Now back to Greg Dalton and his guests at the Commonwealth Club.
And it's time for our lightning round. I'm going to ask each of you a yes or no question, starting with Kim Stanley Robinson. For-profit research into geoengineering is a serious public concern. For-profit research, the profit motive.
Is a serious public concern? I would say no, it's not a serious public concern.
You're not concerned about people making... Okay, fine. I'm sorry. This is yes or no.
Lightning has struck, Stan.
No, but wait. The question is poorly formed. Sure.
It's a lightning round. You don't have to say
sorry, but I misunderstood the question. It shouldn't be for profit. That's stupid. It should be for the public good. It should be a public utility and of the people, by the people, and for the people as a government action.
Oliver Morton, the CIA is working on geoengineering.
Well, the CIA has funded research on geoengineering. Funded reports on research on geoengineering. That's absolutely true. But I have no reason to believe that it's actually working on doing it itself.
They'll hire other people. Ken Caldera, if China can hack the Pentagon, they can hack the sky.
Yes.
Kim Stanley Robinson, you are a liberal who loves the U.S. Navy.
Yes. Except I'm a radical who loves the U.S. Navy, but yes.
You also like GMOs.
I do. You betcha.
Oliver Morton, Kim Stanley Robinson's science fiction is coming uncomfortably close to becoming reality.
Well, I reject the premise of that one. I'm withstanding on this. I think there is a foolish attempt by people to suggest that science fiction and reality are in some ways opposed. I live in a science fictional reality. There is a robot on Mars blasting things with laser beams as we speak. The idea that this is not a science... I mean, there's a guy just there who laughed who makes spacecraft a few blocks south of Market, right? The idea that we are not living in a science fictional world is just preposterous. Of course... Stan's work is part of the world that we live in, but there's no contradiction there.
Planet Labs makes low-orbit satellites here in San Francisco. Ken Caldera, carbon dioxide cuts today have basically no effect on the climate for 30 years.
Lightning.
I'll say no to that one.
You do a lot better than an MIT professor who runs the energy department who was here a couple days ago. He had trouble with yes and no. Ken Caldera, you'll be happy when this lightning round is over.
Yes, I'll get to that.
It's over. All right. There it is. I'd like to ask each of you, when you think about geoengineering, Kim Stanley Robinson, what gives you fear?
That people will do the thing they maybe do with the idea that humanity could live on Mars or on some other planet, that they will take less seriously the responsibility to decarbonize fast.
Oliver Morton, what gives you fear when you think about the prospect for geoengineering?
Well, I think the biggest risks of entailed in relatively small-scale solar geoengineering of the sort we've been talking about, the big risks are geopolitical. Rather than geophysical, in my mind. And what worries me about almost all geopolitical risks is nuclear weapons. And I find it extraordinary that I read people say that geoengineering provides an unparalleled threat to human existence, and it's something unlike anything else we've ever done. We build machines that can end civilization and set them loose in the oceans. I mean, not uncontrolled, obviously, but the idea that geoengineering is a problem that's somehow vaster than the ability we have to start and end nuclear wars doesn't make sense to me. So nuclear war is what worries me about geoengineering.
Ken Caldera?
I think my fear is that the same lack of thoughtful societal deliberation that we're applying to GMOs and healthcare and policy in many areas will also extend to the discussion of geoengineering. It seems that we've devolved into a period where tribalism trumps careful analysis of empirical evidence. And I think unless we can make political decisions based on sound information, our society's in big trouble.
Oliver Morton, you write that planet speak weakens the ties between nature and humans and makes the planet as this abstract geophysical entity, and that talking about the planet distances the problem. That's a problem.
Yes, I do say that. So, not surprisingly, I agree with it. Yes. on Wednesdays and Thursdays, on other days. Yes, the idea of the planet, the very powerful icon for the environmental movement of the planet floating in space, it's extremely powerful, but it's also strangely alienating because it takes us out of the environment that's nurturing us and that we are changing. And that has there's a lot of modernist thought that's similar to this, and it leads to this strange paradox to me that as we feel ourselves divorcing from nature to some extent, living a more urban lifestyle, living with more high-tech food, these sorts of things, living with high energy, we are in a strange, hidden way becoming much more intimate with nature, because there is a sense in the pre-industrial age where you can make a sort of like reasonable distinction between the human and the natural. But when you think that, for instance, due to nitrogen, artificial nitrogen in fertilizers, 40% of the nitrogen atoms in your body come from a factory, that's the sort of thing that makes you realize there is a big, intimate interconnection between what it is to be human and what it is to be part of the planet that we kind of lose when we see the planet over there and us over here behind the moon looking at it and saying, oh, we have a duty to this poor little fragile planet. And that's not the way to think about it. We are inside it. One of the strongest images of the planet, the images of the planet that I keep coming back to at the moment, are the images that you get in the paintings of Turner, where you can't see where the industry and where the weather and where the human activity begin and end, where your whole perspective is within the movements and the motions of this great engine.
Kim Stanley Robinson, let's turn to Hollywood popular culture. There's been a number of films recently, well, going back to The Day After Tomorrow about 10 years ago, which talked about the changing Arctic currents and kind of like Superstorm Sandy hitting New York. Mm-hmm. There's been others. Matt Damon seems to go to different planets all the time. Snowpiercer was
never
a movie.
It works out well for him, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. And Snowpiercer was a film about geoengineering gone wrong. Tell us about the portrayal in popular culture of these concepts.
Well, I've dealt with it myself, and it's a difficult narrative problem because climate change is going to take place over decades or centuries, and so you want your narrative to take place over days or at most months. And indeed, for me, I can speak for myself, and it happened with this movie, The Day After Tomorrow. When they analyzed the Greenland ice core data, they saw that the Younger Dryas, where we went from a warm, a wet world into a cold, dry world, had happened in about 3 years. And they postulated that perhaps the Gulf Stream had shut down because of fresh water on its surface and that this explained it. And all this scientific work and explanation of peculiar data gave us the idea of abrupt climate change, and then I had my story, and so did The Day After Tomorrow. You can tell a story that takes place in 3 years, and it's a frightening one, but it also allows you to get narrative traction on it. So, and also telling the story of things going wrong is inherently more dramatic than the story of things going right, and as a utopian science fiction writer, I've dealt with that one also. So there are several problems for the way that we tell stories to be able to engage with climate change.
Part of all of our story. If you're just joining us, Oliver Morton is the briefings editor at The Economist. Other guests today at Climate One are Ken Caldera, climate scientist from the Carnegie Institution at Stanford, and Kim Stanley Robinson, then author of science fiction. Let's go to our audience questions. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, my name is Matt Stewart. I'm wondering if you were put in charge today and we didn't, let's say, United States, and we didn't have a crazy Congress, you may be able to get something through and you're running for president, what would you do with geoengineering right away?
Oliver, you're British, you're not getting this one, unless you'd like to come back as a as a British sovereign, but I don't know. Ken Caldera?
Well, I don't want to be too self-serving, but as a research scientist, I have to say that I'm in favor of increased research, and so you know, I would greatly increase the research budgets, but engage in the research in a way that has a lot of public input and international collaboration.
Kim Stanley Robinson, any thoughts?
Oh, I bet you'd good pay 100 science fiction novelists to write science fiction novels.
And obviously, I would employ many journalists to do equally fine work. But I must say, I mean, I think the most important thing would be to say this is something we need to learn about and talk about, but we can. As America has the greatest scientific infrastructure in the world, we can learn a lot about it and we can take a strong role in that, but we are not going to be leaders of the world in discussing how to use this. We're going to put this knowledge at the disposal of our friends and colleagues around the world in order to have a discussion that it's worthwhile having.
But Oliver Morton, you're the environmental editor at The Economist. Many environmentalists think that this, even having this discussion, is harmful and counterproductive to their ends.
That's certainly true because there are various reasons for that. One of them is that they don't feel that this addresses the ultimate cause of the problem. And there's obviously truth in that. And I think that it's very important, as I've said before in this conversation, to address carbon dioxide emissions as well as to talk about this sort of stuff, let alone to do this sort of stuff. But one of the underlying causes of the problem is not addressing the problem. And so, in a sense, by addressing the problem, one of the things you do is at least you address the problem. You have a story out there that's getting told about what you can actually do.
Can I add,
Stanley Robinson?
Since you're postulating a kind of a kingly moment, a carbon tax that increases over time, a solar credit so that people could put solar photovoltaic and solar water heating, and also a full employment, everybody gets a job that wants one in landscape restoration and in creation of wetlands, creation of reforesting the deforested areas. A lot of work to be done. And so these things are specific policies that could really help in this situation.
We're talking about geoengineering at Climate One, geoengineering being the idea of bouncing sunlight, sun power from the sky back out into outer space using various technological means. Let's go to our next question. Welcome.
No kidding, outer space. So I'm Joe Mascaro from Planet Labs. We launch small satellites for Earth observation. My question is about our perception of how human civilization interacts with our biosphere. I think historically we've thought of human civilization as something nested within the biosphere. And that is no longer true. I mean, already we have a portion of human civilization living on the Martian surface in the form of the Opportunity and Curiosity rovers. We have the space station. How do you think that we ought to recalibrate our perception of the moral considerations of geoengineering with respect to the fact that we clearly already today have a civilization that exceeds the scope geographically of our biosphere?
Who'd like to tackle that one? Ken Caldera?
I'll let these guys give better answers than me, but I'm kind of a Luddite, actually, on this one, in that I would like to see humans withdraw to as compact an area as possible and allow wilderness to flourish in the rest of the planet. That's my utopic vision. And
that's not being a Luddite. That's just being an American. and, you know, and many of my best friends. But I live in a country which has parts of it which are extraordinarily beautiful, no part of which can be reasonably described as a wilderness, and where we're discussing creating radical novel ecosystems to make it more beautiful. I find the idea that the humans must be a small set of side part in a great wilderness. I understand the power of that idea, but I think you have to realize it's a very culturally specific idea.
Kim Stanley Robinson, retreat, sort of restore balance of human and nature?
No, but the space science is an Earth science, and the solar system is our neighborhood. And when we talk about Mars, we are thinking about planets, and when we think about planets, we're realizing we're on a planet. And so it's all good in that regard. And this is the only planet we can live on and stay healthy, and I think that will be true for tens of thousands of years. So there is no planet B, and that moral hazard is taken away as soon as you understand that. But studying these other places, sending robots with cameras, and sending people as scientific stations the way we sent people to Antarctica a century ago, it's all fantastically interesting and exciting and useful and beautiful.
Let's go to our next audience question. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Mark Harnett. Is there a way to test the solar engineering on a local level? Once you put stuff into the stratosphere, does it necessarily affect the whole planet? And then who do you think is going to do it first and when?
There's no way to test, as it were, sort of like the planetary effect without getting a planetary effect. There are ways to, you could test some of the side effects by doing small experiments. You could test some of the what happens to the chemistry and physics of the upper atmosphere when you put this in. Some people have suggested that you might be able to do short-term effects on something like a heat wave. But in general, this is a planetary sort of phenomenon, and you will not know exactly what you get until you get it. But that's also true of non-deliberate climate change. I mean, the models that tell you what to expect under increased greenhouse warming are the same models as the models that tell you what to expect under greenhouse warming plus geoengineering. And then they get no less accurate when you add in the geoengineering. In fact, We may not want to go into this now, but Ken's occasionally argued to me that they're possibly more accurate when they deal with geoengineering and global warming than global warming alone.
Ken Caldera, could this be tested regionally? There are some suggestions for along the California coast or other places.
First, to reiterate what Oliver said, that there is one reason to do experiments is to learn about local process effects. But there have been proposals which have not yet been evaluated that, for example, a fine mist could be created off the coast of California that would then cool the ocean and increase the amount of coastal fog, which is dissipating as the planet continues to warm. And the California coastal redwoods depend on this fog for the water, so not all that water goes up the trunk. Some of it's getting absorbed by the leaves. And if this fog goes away, a lot of the coastal redwoods could go away. And so it's been suggested that a fine spray might be able to maintain the coastal redwoods. Similarly, if the ocean's cooled off in this way, it's likely that a increased cool, moist sea breeze could come into the desert southwest, or at least it's possible. And the idea that, by spraying some seawater in the air, that you might be able to cool off what will become an increasingly parched region might become attractive. And so these are still in the realm of speculation, but I think it's the kind of thing that people would like to understand better.
Those would be projects, though, that weren't aimed in and of themselves at changing the global climate. Though if you added such projects together across the face of the globe, you would have a global change, but then that's very hard to predict what would actually happen.
Right. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, I'm Jessica Loving from the Breakthrough Institute. I have a opposing hypothetical geoengineering experiment. So suppose we're really successful at deploying clean energy, shutting down coal plants, providing people electricity so they stop burning wood and dung, we'd have a dramatic decrease in particulate emissions, which could cause a short-term dramatic warming. Is that something that's studied, or is it so infeasible that we'd actually do it that it's not of a concern?
So Ken Caldera, shutting down coal plants could make the world hotter.
Yes. Coal plants today, I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but some substantial fraction, probably over half the warming that's caused by our carbon dioxide emissions is offset by sulfur coming out of coal plants, largely from Asian coal plants. And if those were shut down instantaneously, the planet would warm up substantially. And if the Chinese, as they shut down their coal plants, maybe took 5% of that sulfur and put it higher in the atmosphere, they would maintain that cooling. And so this idea that maybe we're already emitting sulfur into the atmosphere and cooling the Earth through the burning of coal, and if that could be maybe done more thoughtfully and reduce those emissions by 95% but still get the same cooling effect.
Let's go to our next question. Welcome.
Hi. When we talk about geoengineering, we hear a lot about the atmosphere. My question is, would geoengineering be important or begin at the ocean level? And do we adequately understand enough about how oceans affect climate and ocean processes affect the climate?
Ken Caldera, you've written about this.
Yeah, well, one proposal which we vetted in some model simulations last year, the deep ocean is very cold. On average, it's less than 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And so one idea to cool the Earth is to bring some of this cold water up to the surface and then take this warm water at the surface and stuff it down into the deep ocean. And what we found in our simulations is that this warm surface water also helps maintain the clouds. And when this cold water was brought up, the clouds went away, and then the sun warmed this dark ocean surface. And by the end of the century, the planet was warmer than it would have been had you never attempted doing this. And so people are thinking about various ocean interventions just from a modeling point of view. But so far, I would say the proposals, at least the proposals that we've looked at, haven't been very promising.
It's really interesting the way that the ocean has this huge controlling effect on climate, and yet the atmosphere gets all the attention. That's right, because the atmosphere is easier to change. And the atmosphere is a kind of small thing, right? It's about the same mass as the Mediterranean Sea. It's tiny compared to the oceans. And that's why industrial civilization is able to change the climate so much is because the atmosphere is actually quite small. I just find that a very, very telling idea. It's like it provides a certain amount of leverage, and it's hard to find other levers to move the ocean around with other than the atmosphere.
We had Sylvia Earle here last year. There's a podcast on climateone.org and iTunes. She talked about how oceans eloquently drive the climate rather than people think the other way around, that the atmosphere affects the oceans. It's the oceans that drive weather and climate. Ken Caldera.
If you compress the atmosphere down to the density of water, it's only about 30 feet deep. And so one way to think of all the pollution we're putting into the atmosphere, it's like putting it into a lake that's 30 feet deep. And so it's understandable that our pollution will accumulate and have substantial effects.
Ken Caldera is a climate scientist at Stanford. We're also talking with Oliver Morton from The Economist magazine and Kim Stanley Robinson, the science fiction author. We're getting close to the end. I want to ask you what an average person listening to this can do to have an influence, not to get involved in geoengineering in their backyard, but what an average person can do, Ken Caldera, to have a positive influence. And I'm going to wrap up with one last question to each of you.
Well, it's good for people to reduce their own carbon footprints and so on. I think really this is a political problem that will be solved by changing our entire energy and transportation infrastructures. And so I think the most important thing that people can do is let their elected representatives know that their votes depend on them supporting sound climate policy.
So democracy will solve the problem. Oliver Morton, what can an average person do?
I'm not particularly enamored of these ideas of incremental action because I think it lets the political system off the hook. I think that the problem is that, to some extent, if people of goodwill act and people not of goodwill don't act, then you don't have a solution to the problem. The idea, this is why politics is absolutely fundamental to this. The idea is to find things that people who disagree about a lot can agree on doing, and that's a political process. So I would say to some extent, as Ken does, political answer. But I'd also say you should get interested in the processes of the Earth. Geoengineering is about changing processes of the Earth. You live on an extraordinary planet, and we understand that planet far better than we ever have before. And simply trying to partake of some of that understanding with a spirit of reverence and a spirit of awe to the extent that you want, but also with a spirit of fascination and wonder at the mechanisms involved, I think that's both politically useful and I think it's life-enhancing. So I think that's what people should do.
Watch those David Attenborough documentaries. Kim Stanley Robinson, you came down here from Sacramento on the train today. What else can people do, average people, to have an impact?
Keep a garden, compost, ride a bike, work outdoors, vote leftist, don't believe in the capitalist system. The market system is actually causing the mass extinction event, so there's not really a market solution. We actually need post-capitalism. So think post-capitalism. What is that? It's mysterious. You Google it, you get nothing. That's in itself remarkable because we need it bad.
I can't resist. We have a very market-based person here from...
A man who works for a very market-based magazine.
Okay.
But I would also point out, as many people, including Jim McCusker, various people point out, there is a difference between markets and capitalism.
Are markets part of the problem or part of the solution or both, Oliver Morton?
Markets can be part of some of the solution, but markets are not a solution. No market solution will be articulated through geoengineering, or rather, no geoengineering solution, I think, will be articulated through the market.
We have to wrap it up there. We've been talking about geoengineering, the idea of bouncing sun's radiation back up into the sky and other means here at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club with Kim Stanley Robinson, the science fiction author, Oliver Morton from The Economist, and Ken Caldera, a climate scientist at Stanford. I'm Greg Dalton. You can join the conversation on Twitter using our handle at Climate One and listen podcast of this and other programs on our website, climateone.org. Thanks to the audience here in the room at the Commonwealth Club and online and on our air. Thank you all, and thank our guests. Thanks.
Climate One is the sustainability initiative at the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization. I'm Greg Dalton, the executive producer. Kelly Pennington is our director of audience engagement. Jane Ann Chen is the producer. The audio engineer is William Bloom. The Commonwealth Club's CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Join us next week for a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment.